This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I say that with a little bit of a laugh because typically at this time, I introduce my co-host Kerry Kasem and tell everyone that Kerry is going to manage your life as well. But today, Kerry didn't manage her own life that well because she couldn't make it into the studio. She called just about an hour and a half ago and said she had a previous engagement that didn't allow her to be here today. And I am so excited because we have a replacement for Kerry Kasem last minute, one of our favorite guests and someone who has co-hosted this show in the past, Troy Slayton.
Thank you so much for having me, Alan. Great to be here. And does that mean because I came in, you know, with just a couple hours notice that am I on the D list?
You are not on the D list. A list. You're the first sub.
Oh, okay.
If you would have said no, we would have had to go through a list of other potential co-hosts who've been here. And Troy is no stranger to the media. He's on CNN and Fox and every other outlet all the time. One of Ashley Banfield's, you sub for her sometimes, don't you?
I did. Yes.
Yeah.
Her show is no longer on HLN.
I know it isn't.
I did that. And I'm on Nancy Grace's. I was on her TV show many times. And then she's not on HLN anymore, but I've been on her radio show. She has a new show that's going to be on Fox Nation.
Oh, she does?
Yes. And I am going to be on that.
Troy, I don't know why I'm having you on. You've just told me that two of the hosts of the shows no longer are on the air.
No, they got canceled.
So I guess this is my last week.
Probably.
All right. Well, thanks for warning
me. I'm the cooler.
Genevieve, you could have gotten someone else. I don't know why you got Troy. But Troy, I do want to congratulate you first off because I know you had a very, I would say, a successful campaign, although unfortunately the results weren't successful.
I think it's only successful if you win.
But you had a great campaign.
So now I'm a former candidate for the Los Angeles Superior Court.
All right. Well, but you did do a great job.
Thank
and I
you.
Know a lot of people put their support behind you and, you know, you'll get them next time.
We had a lot of great support, and I extend my huge and absolutely heartfelt thanks to everybody that supported the campaign.
Was it fun campaigning?
It was. I got to meet a lot of great people. I got to hear about the issues that were important to people and what folks thought about the court system and the criminal justice system. I got to meet all of the candidates for district attorney.
Yeah.
And including Gascon and Lacey and Rossi. It looks like Gascon may very well be in a runoff with Jackie Lacey.
Yeah, I saw that.
By only about 16 votes.
That's crazy.
That is the epitome of why every vote matters.
Every vote does matter. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, we have an exciting show today because we're going to learn about how every vote matters. You know, you were running for Superior Court.
So this is a political show today.
I would think so. But, you know, with every political show, there's background. It's interesting to find out about who the person is. For instance,
The backstory
of Troy Slayton. You were a child actor.
I was.
Cagney and Lacey.
I'm now a recovering actor.
A recovering child actor. And, of course, Parker Lewis can't lose.
Yes.
You well known. You had a good run. What was more fun, being a child actor or running for judicial office?
There is no better job in the world than being an actor on a show that's actually on the air, there's nothing better. Well, it's the best work in the world if you can get it.
I don't know that's true for everyone, because some child actors just didn't do as well. As they moved on.
Many of my contemporaries, many of my peers ended up in the toilet.
Yeah. And speaking of which, and I don't want to say it, 2 weeks ago, we had Corey Feldman here, and tomorrow is a huge event, which I'm going to go to. There's red carpet and everything. His documentary, My Truth, The Rape of Two Coreys. That's Corey Feldman and Corey Haim. He is showing his movie, the documentary, My Truth, only one time. He's streaming it live. It costs $20 to go to. I'm going to see it. I'm going to be at the red carpet event with Corey. He was nice enough to invite Carrie and I. And, of course, Carrie's going to show up to that, not to the show today. But she'll go there. Yes. And I hear it's sold out. There's going to be a lot of media. Corey Feldman says he's going to name names. He was on the show. He talked about it, about producing this documentary, My Truth, The Rape of Two Coreys. So if you're interested, it's only going to be showing once, because he only has enough money right now to show it once. Streaming live tomorrow at 8 p.m. L.A. time. You can go to mytruthdoc.com, mytruthdoc.com. If you want to experience what Corey Feldman has put together to name names about sexual abuse for children.
Well, he's been talking for years about this scourge that he saw in Hollywood of pedophilia and abuse of children. And I was working pretty consistently from age 5. And I'm not discounting anything that he said at all. But my experience didn't involve any of that at all, not even a whisper, not even a hint. I don't know whether it was because I had a parent that was around most of the time. My mom was on the set with me almost all the time, or it would be a good family friend. And I had good studio teachers that also act as the welfare workers. They're supposed to act as a welfare worker for the child to make sure that all the child labor laws are being followed. I never saw anything like that. Maybe they just weren't attracted to me.
Maybe you had a different mindset. Maybe you were lucky. I don't know. But, you know, sometimes we look to the legislature in order to make sure that the laws protect children, people who have been subject to domestic violence, kids who are going into kindergarten in education, and we're going to talk about some of the legislation involving that. There are a number of areas that are of interest to our two next guests. And I think when you talk about education and you talk about domestic abuse and violence, these are topics that are so important that legislation is important that we address. And we are very privileged here at Gervie's Law to have the first sisters to serve in the California legislature. They're sisters, an assemblywoman and a senator. They are two of the most 25 most powerful political figures in the region, LA County. That's what they've been called. They have risen from a very interesting backstory. Just as you were a child actor, they had a very different background.
If you think my backstory is interesting, theirs is 10 times more compelling.
It is. And it's very important because, as you said, it's only a select few who are child actors. But when we're talking about immigration and we're talking about what we can say is an undocumented worker, an undocumented immigrant, these are important issues that they are very familiar with because they were deported. And that's what we want to talk about. We want to introduce right now to Gervie's Law, Assemblywoman Blanca Rubio and Senator Susan Rubio. We're so happy to have you with us.
Thank you for having us. Great to be here.
Yes, thank you. This is Assemblywoman Rubio, and we're going to have to figure out how to identify ourselves.
Well, you've been dealing with that for a long time. You're only a year apart in age, so I'm sure, and you look similar. So I'm sure you've had that situation. It's just a little more difficult when you're on the phone. Are you together or are you in separate places?
No, we're actually together. We weren't not going to be in Sacramento at the same time, but she happened to fly in and I happened to fly in and we ended up together. We actually share a home together in Sacramento when we because we have to commute from our districts to Sacramento. So we share a home and we're actually sitting at home right now together.
That is amazing.
So Sunday family dinner.
Yes.
I'm interested to know what you guys are eating because I'm sure it's something amazing because all of my Mexican-American friends and family members eat the most amazing food on Sunday nights.
Yes, absolutely. And I also happen to have my father up here. I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, and my dad helps us kind of when I'm not here. And so he's been here all day, and we got home to an amazing chicken dinner with rice and beans and tortillas. That's kind of a staple in our house. And so, yes, we are going to be having amazing dinner as soon as we get done with hopefully an amazing interview with you guys.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring up your father, and it's a great backstory. Your father's name isn't Kennedy, and I'm just quoting Susan Rubio, who said, "I used to believe you could only be in politics if you were elected, if you were a Kennedy." And interestingly enough, next week on our show, we have Rory Kennedy, and we're speaking to Rory Kennedy, who is the daughter of Robert Kennedy, and she was born 6 months after he was assassinated. She's also the same person who John Kennedy Jr., he was going to her wedding when his plane went down. What a horrible thing to have your wedding, and John Kennedy Jr. was killed on the way to her wedding. She's had a lot of real traumas in her life, and she's making documentary films on some of the most incredible subjects that I think both of you would be very interested in. So while you may not be Kennedys, and we're going to talk to Rory Kennedy next week, I think you have a lot of the same perspectives in terms of trying to help people. Blanca, tell us the backstory, because you mentioned your father. Tell us about how he originally, with your mother, came to this country and ended up being deported.
Well, so back in the early 60s, they had what they called the Bracero program. And I think it might have been earlier than the 60s, but my father is going to be 80 years old this year. So he's been in and out of the country since he was 19 years old. At the time, you know, it was very customary for folks in the border regions to come across to the United States and work. And my father was one of many. Once he got married to my mom, he still went back and forth. Again, we're from Juarez, which is on the border of El Paso, Texas, and Mexico. And so it was, again, very easy for them to apply for those programs and come across to the United States. But once the program ended, and when I speak to folks, I always tell them that once the program ended, we still needed to eat. So my dad kept coming back to the United States. At that point, the program had ended. So technically he was crossing the border undocumented. When I was about, I want to say about 5 or 6 years old, we went to a little town called Weenie, Texas, which is on the border of Louisiana and Texas. And that's where we started this whole journey that we're on. We obviously stood out from the rest of the group. We didn't really speak the language at all. And so it was a difficult time for us in school in particular, because the teachers didn't really know what to do with us because they didn't know how to communicate, obviously. And anyway, so my father took us to Weenie, and Sundays are family times, we spend time with family. And at that time we were at a park, and my dad, all I remember was looking up and seeing my dad with some men in uniform. Turns out it was INS at that time. Now it's ICE, but at the time it was INS, Immigration Naturalization Administration. Anyway, and it was the INS folks talking to my dad, asking him for his paperwork. And, you know, again, since the program had ended, he didn't really have any paperwork except for his local passport. And that's when they found out that we were undocumented and we were deported at that time.
Wow.
And how old were you guys?
I was six, so I'm 14 months older than my sister. My sister Susan's a twin, so I'm 14 months older than the twins. And the youngest sister was probably one or two at the time. But
that's Sylvia, right?
I vaguely remember I was 5 or 6 years old at the time.
I was four. This is Susan. I was four.
Okay.
And so Susan, do you have any memories, or is that something that you've just been told the stories about as you got older?
Oh, no, I absolutely remember this. As a teacher, I can tell you that children remember everything, especially if it's a traumatic experience,
right,
as that
right.
one was. I just remember we had such a happy childhood with our parents, and that's one of those moments that stands out in many ways, in particular because I remember the moment that those gentlemen approached my father, and my parents always, did a great job of protecting us. But in that moment, I could see his face. It was just terror. Like, I knew in that moment, like, he wanted to protect us, but it was impossible. He couldn't shield us from what was happening. And so it's a memory that's imprinted in my mind, and it's something that I've never forgotten.
You know, I hope you also have memories of your father's face, your parents' face, when you were elected, both as in the Assembly and in the Senate, because that's something that you really want to replace, that kind of difficult memory when you were a kid.
Well, in many ways, I can tell you that as bad as it was, it's something that I think Blanca and I can be thankful for, because I think that's where our drive comes from, our determination, and just, our ability to connect with people and wanting to make a difference and help our families that are very similar to ours. And so because of that incident, I think that's why we've become successful in taking care of our community.
Interesting. I was going to say, it's an interesting perspective. We're going to pick up on it. We have to, unfortunately, take a quick break. But
okay.
I think it's important what you said. We want to talk a lot more about how you came to where you are now. And then we want to talk about the issues that are important to you. We're talking to Assemblywoman Blanca Rubio and Senator Susan Rubio, two sisters in the California legislature, listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yes, we are back. You're listening to Gervie's Law. If you want to call in, it's 800-222-5222, 800-222-5222. We're speaking with Assemblywoman Blanca Rubio and her sister, Susan Rubio, Senator for the 22nd Senate District. Pretty incredible that the two of you have come to become legislators in California after undergoing such a difficult path. Not everyone has the opportunities that you have made for yourselves after being deported and then coming back. And before the break, you were telling us about your father and your mother working hard, trying to give what they could to their children. And are there four of you? I know, Susan, you have your twin.
Five of us now. There's five now. So we call my youngest brother a change of life baby. He didn't really go through any of the things that we're discussing. My dad was 51 and my mom was 45, and he's just turned 28.
Wow.
So, and we've been in the country now since 1977. It'll be 43 years in August, the day Elvis died. So I've been accused of killing Elvis before, because that's the day we arrived into the country.
Well, I got to say something, that obviously there was a lot of distraction in the country. So your entrance in the country must have been very quiet. You just were watching the television with the Elvis stuff.
Yep, everybody was focused on Elvis, and we managed to sneak back in at that time. But so my youngest brother wasn't born until 1991. And so by then we had done, I'd kind of gotten past the whole being undocumented. And so this is Blanca. I'm the oldest, and Susan and Robert, and then the youngest is Sylvia. And then my youngest brother, Brian, who is currently serving in the Army, actually. He's in Baumholder, Germany, right now. But so he's kind of, like I said, a change of life baby. separate from the experiences that Susan, Sylvia, Robert, and I went through. But so, yes, we managed to come back to the country. And I like to talk about how our life, you know, kind of didn't make any, I don't want to say sense. I think we weren't, when we're fighting now, it wasn't kind of what was imprinted us in the beginning, because when we got back to, we came back to the country after being deported, we ended up in downtown LA. And now when I was running for assembly in I was elected in 2016, but in 2014, that's when really the campaign started. As Troy can tell you, this is a long process. But anyway, when I was running, we all asked, everybody wants to know who your consultant is. Consultants are a big deal, I guess, in this business.
Right.
I found a consultant and he wanted to know what my story was. He was like, hey, what's your story? And I was like, what do you mean? I've got no story. I'm a teacher. You know, at that point, I was like, yeah, I'm just this a teacher. I've been, you know, kind of just talking about the present. And he's like, no. Like, what's your story? What's like the compelling story? And I'm like,
this
I don't
is a quintessential American success story.
Right. But at the time when he started asking to us, and I'll tell you why, we grew up in downtown L.A. Guess how many of our friends have the same story we did? You know, when he was asking about where we were born and he asked that, then that's when I told him, well, you know, we were born in Mexico and then we were deported. He's like, wait, stop right there. That's the story. And he says, well, why didn't you start with that? I'm like, because everybody around us in downtown LA, we grew up in the Pico Union area, had a similar story than we did. So we didn't really think that there was, you know, anything unusual or special about what we were talking about, because so many of our friends were in the same situation as we were. Well, come to find out that it is a story, obviously. Now, you know, when we keep telling it, it is a big deal, because, you know, we were deported and undocumented. But I think for us, like Susan stated earlier, that's where our drive comes from. But we also represent a big portion of what our communities look like.
And to the country, you know, that has given you so much. Your brother is serving in the military. You both are serving in the state legislature. And even your sister, Sylvia, was attempting to join you.
Yeah, what is the status on that? Because she was going up against the color, and there's some interesting things that you both pushed her into this.
Yes.
One political dynasty in an older political dynasty in California going up against a newer political dynasty here in California.
Well, for us, we didn't look at it as a dynasty. We're looking at it as, like, you know, we're just public servants and we wanted to do what was right for our communities. And so, yes, Sylvia was running. We're 900 votes behind. So at this point, it's, you know, it's about counting. But I just have to tell you that the numbers are not necessarily in our favor. So we're still waiting it out. But, you know, we do want to congratulate Lisa Calderon for her work, because I think after this all is done, Lisa Calderon will probably be the assembly member for that district.
And she will be replacing Ian, who is her stepson, right?
And that's correct. And I would say, this is Susan Rubio, as Troy can attest, I mean, anyone that puts their name out there to try and serve, it is not an easy road. It is sometimes vicious and hard, and you put, you know, 24 hours a day into your work. So again, to any candidate out there that wasn't successful, I commend all of you, because I know how hard it was for me and for Assembly Member Blanca Rubio. So it is something that we recognize to anyone out there. We at least have to try. I know people say, are you okay that Sylvia wasn't successful? And I usually tell them, well, 2/3 of the Rubio sisters are legislators. You know, our family is going to be just fine. But
I wanted to ask you, because Sylvia, is she the reason how you were able to come to the country? Because wasn't she born here?
Yes. So, yes, absolutely. Sylvia was born in El Paso during one of the times that our family was in the United States. So, yes. So back in those days, when we came, when Elvis died, when we came, the law was different. So anybody that was born in the United States could sponsor their family members, regardless of the age. And at that time, I think I became documented when I was 13. So I'm 4 years older. So Sylvia was 9. So at that time, the law was that if you're an American citizen, naturally born citizen, you can sponsor your family. And that you're correct. That is the reason why we ended up fixing our status at that time. Because we were deported, there was a lot of processes that we had to go through. I think we had to go in front of a judge and get pardoned for being deported, if I'm not mistaken. I may be mistaken. I was little at the time. But I do remember we had to go back to Juarez and go to the embassy for some reason. But I think we had to go be in front of a judge and get a pardon for our being deported. Then the process began where Sylvia was able to sponsor the family into the country. And so I was documented when I was 13, and Susan and Robert were 12. And
so you had to jump through a lot of hoops, but you did it the right way. You dotted all the I's, you crossed all the T's, and you did it the right way.
Can I add, Troy? I know that, you know, it sounds like the right way, but the reality is that that's the only choice we had at the time. And I can tell you that the process to become a U.S. citizen now, it is almost unattainable. And I say that because we were, like Blanca shared, I became a legal resident at 13 and 12. But it wasn't until we were in our mid-20s that we became U.S. citizens because of all the hoops and paperwork we have to fill out. I think that I still am a person believe that things need to get tighter in terms of, a path to legal status. We have to jump through a lot of hoops, but again, the process right now is still very difficult.
Yes, I can attest to that. I've had many, many years of real complications trying to get into this country as a student on visas, and then afterwards as a lawyer. It took me getting married to be able to stay here. So even for Canadians, it has been a very, very difficult process, and I don't think people realize how much hard work you put into it. Whether you do everything right or wrong, I mean, I remember a couple times crossing over the border telling the customs people that I'd be back and never went back. But, that was just a long time ago. But it isn't.
Right.
I mean, sometimes you do what you have to do in order to, reach your goals, I guess. But I'm not advocating any type of illegal acts, but I think you two both realize that this isn't easy.
Yeah, it isn't. And it's difficult, when you're faced, a lot of these people that are trying to come to the United States, like we were, you have a choice of, dying, because we were from Juarez, and and if you do any research on the status of not just the drug situation down there, but also there's a lot of stories about the women of Juarez that have been murdered and never been seen, ever again. And so, that the choices for our parents was grow up in a situation like that or bring us into the country. And Susan said that when we applied to become citizens, it was a difficult, just the paperwork process was terrible. Never mind the whole process, right? But in order to get an application, we had to get up. We were in line at 6 a.m. because if you weren't in line by 6 a.m., by the time they got you into the door, it was 12 hours later. I mean, literally, just getting an application was difficult. Once we applied to become citizens, and this is nothing to do with our fixing our legal status when I was 13. This is, we were already legal at this point.
Right.
And we had to wait in lines, for that. And I have to tell you, that whole process was just terrible. We finally became citizens in 1994, and this is a true story. In 1995, I got a letter from the Immigration Department saying, if you don't send in the required documents, we're going to cancel your application. And I'm like, wait a minute. I've already been sworn in to, I was already sworn in as a U.S. citizen, and then I'm getting some random letter from the department saying that my application is going to be canceled when, by my records and my swearing in as a U.S. citizen, that process had been taken care of in 1994.
That's bizarre. So, that is really
bizarre. The bureaucracy just didn't know what it was doing. Sometimes the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing.
That's crazy.
Right.
Hopefully that isn't happening too often because, obviously it's disconcerting when you're sworn in, and then all of a sudden you get a letter, and you're like, what happened? We got to take a quick break.
Ellen,
yeah, go ahead.
This is Susan. I just want to add really quickly. You know, the biggest misconception, and I'm sorry, but I hear it so often, is like, why don't people get in the back of the line and do it right? But what I want to convey is there is no back of the line. It is chaos. It is years of work. It is tedious. So it's not like going to one line one day and getting legal status. It is hoop after hoop after hoop. So I just want to clarify, there is no back of the line. It's a really terrible situation and time consuming, and it's a lot of work, and we do it gladly, but I think there, our system needs a little bit fixing.
Yeah, I think reform is very important in this area. I don't know why people are talking about walls when they need to be talking about reform, which can do things, as you say, properly. We got to take a break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We are speaking to Assemblywoman Blanca Rubio and her sister, Susan Rubio, Senator, 22nd District. And Blanca tweets at Sen, I'm sorry, Susan tweets at Sen Susan Rubio and ASM Blanca Rubio for Blanca Rubio. Wow, what a great handle for tweeting. You get your senator and assembly member. What did it feel like when you actually, and I know it was at different times, Blanca first and then Susan, what did it feel like when you were actually in Sacramento and you're in the Senate or you're in the assembly and there you are after this really, really compelling backstory and motivating for so many people. There you are, standing there legislating.
Well, of course, it was a tremendous honor to be at this in the state capitol. I think, as you've heard us talk, we're very close as a family. So nothing beats hanging out with your sister at work, you know. And so that was really incredible. I remember the time, my very first state of the state address with the governor. We had the opportunity to sit down together. And I remember just looking over to her saying, like, what other sister gets to hang out with her sister at work, listening to the governor speak. So it's really an honor and a privilege. But, you know, at the same time, we talk about it as a family. It's a big responsibility because, you know, it falls on our shoulders to do good work and make sure that we make our family proud first and foremost, but also do good work so that our community could be proud. And I'm really glad that Troy's on the phone here because I want to make sure that I talk about some of the exciting things that I'm working on as it pertains to the criminal justice system. So, for example, last year,
criminal justice reform was a huge part of my platform in my race for judge. And we should let the listeners know that I probably didn't win because you endorsed my opponent, Adan Multibon.
Oh, but you never reached out to us.
Oh, well, you just endorse somebody in the race and you don't even reach out to the opponent?
No, it doesn't work that way. The opponent is the one that has to reach out to the folks.
Oh, I guess that's my fault. I guess why I'm a political novice and why I'm not in office and you are.
Well, to be fair, we were running my other sister Sylvia's campaign. So we were a little busy. So I'm sorry we didn't get to reach out. But so let me just share with the bill that I passed last year, which is SB 273. One of the reasons I ran in particular, I had been a survivor of domestic violence, and I really wanted to do something to protect victims and expand protection. So SB 273 extended the statute of limitations for victims to bring their abusers to justice. Currently, we have 3 years. And after 3 years, time is up. And through my research and talking to victims, we found that the average time it takes a victim to recover is 8 years. A lot of them are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. And so it takes a lot before a victim can come forward and really seek justice. So I'm very proud that I was able to extend the statute from 3 years to 5.
It's such a wonderful legislation. Gloria Allred comes on our show all the time. She's co-hosted with me. Her daughter, Susan Bloom.
Lisa Bloom.
Lisa Bloom.
Lisa Bloom.
You know, Lisa's always on the show, and they talked about this when it was going on SB 273. They talked about how important it is for exactly the reasons you're talking about you know, extending the statute. So when we talk about that, how I understand you're saying, you know, you subject of domestic violence, is that what motivates you? And can we talk about Roger Hernandez or a former assembly member as part of this? Is this what motivates you?
Well, you are welcome to ask questions. I reserve the right to answer or not answer. I'm just joking. Go ahead. And
so Roger Hernandez was a former assembly member, and it's been all in the news, so I'm not saying anything out of school here. You were there was domestic violence involved in your marriage, and this is what prompted you to help others who were subject to the same thing or similar circumstances, even though their husband or spouse may not have been an assembly member.
That's correct. And, well, because I realized at the time I was also a local elected official. I was a council member. And, I, you know, by all accounts, I mean, I'm very successful. I have a master's degree. And the reason I say that is that if someone as affluent as myself with connections and services can fall in a trap like that, then what hope is there for other victims that perhaps don't have financial support or a great family like I do that's there for you? So I really wanted to advocate and make sure that the laws were fair and that it was easier for victims to reach out for services and also be able to take their abusers to justice.
And while we certainly want to protect victims of domestic violence and of all types of violent crimes, what about the person, though, the person who's accused? And as an attorney who's represented many people who are accused, some who are guilty, some who are innocent, to have to defend a case after, let's say, 8 years, 7 years, 8 years, when memories fade, things get lost, evidence goes stale, doesn't it become hard for the person who may be accused rightfully or wrongfully to defend a case 8 years later?
Well, yeah, my bill in particular wanted to be very clear about what was necessary. And we definitely wanted to have a provision that included proof. And that meant audio, video, and any other proving evidence. And I'll tell you, there was a victim who came to me who, after 3 years, had text messages threatening her life, had video, audio, and none of that was made a difference. She still couldn't use it to file charges. So again, we want to be fair and we want to make sure that it's a rightful accusations. But I included the evidence base because I understand there could be false circumstances as well.
And I think as an attorney, that's what we're looking at all the time. We're looking at the evidence, weighing the evidence. And if it isn't there, it isn't there. If it is, it is. So everyone should be given the fair shot to present their case on both sides. And wherever the truth lies, that's really what we're looking at. On to a different subject, education. Susan had said that every time we fight for a child in a classroom, we feel it's something we owe our brother. Tell us what you meant by that.
Well, as my sister Blanca shared, I am a twin. And when we came to this country, when we came to California, we landed in Pico Union, which is a predominantly Latino community. But back in the 70s, to the detriment of my brother, there was a test that was allowed to be given that would test your IQ based on your language. And of course, he had a harder time learning the language. So he scored very low. And because of that test, they deemed him at the time, it said special education. So he was not only taken out of a regular classroom, but even in that time in the 70s, you couldn't attend the same school. So they segregated him. They bused him to another school with severely handicapped children. And so he was a fluent Spanish speaker. He went from speaking Spanish to being a non-speaker. He started mimicking every behavior of every child he was around. Years later, the school district realized they had made a mistake, but at that time they had already ruined his self-esteem, his opportunity to succeed. And as soon as he was old enough, he dropped out of school and left the state. And so when I say every time my sister and I are focused on a child or trying to ensure that these kids are successful,
we look back and we had a conversation, and we know that every child means still trying to save my brother, even though we were children at the time and we couldn't do anything for him. So we continue to try to help others.
Well, and this is Blanca now. Part of that also is why we became teachers. I became a teacher in 2000 during a teacher shortage, and shortly after that, Susan became a teacher. And I think, you know, our work just as teachers, were, both of us were trying to you know, prevent other children from going through what we went through, and mainly what my brother went through. And so I think, you know, on top of the whole immigration story, just the disenfranchised child that comes with that, because they don't speak the language, the parents don't necessarily know the school system. For us, and me in particular, when I was a teacher, that was the main, you know, reason why I went to work every day, is because I knew that maybe I couldn't do anything for my brother anymore, but I knew that I could help the kids that were in my classroom at that time, whether it be 20 when I was teaching kindergarten or 34 when I was teaching fourth grade, was that I was going to make sure that nothing ever happened to those kids, similar to what happened to my brother. And so the teaching part, I think, was kind of the foundation of our advocacy, because we wanted to advocate for kids. And once I was elected in 2016, you know, so currently I'm on a quote unquote leave of absence from teaching until I finish my term. But to me, what I could do in the classroom was isolated to those 34 kids that I had contact with, you know, every year. But on the state level, can you imagine the things that we, you know, have done and are going to be able to do to advocate for children? You know, I'm for me being on the committee for health and human services, I get to work with the foster youth system a lot.
Yeah.
And so all of those experiences are helping us advocate for the different types of issues that are happening within the state.
Yeah, and the other thing, and we have to take a break, but I just want to mention AB 2500 that Susan Rubio has been supported by Senator Bill Dodd, who was on our show a couple years back now, the TK Transitional Kindergarten Bill. Wonderful work to try and get four-year-olds into the education system, something that I support, and I'm glad that you're focused on education. We got to take a break. One more segment. You were listening to Gervie's Law. We're talking to Assemblywoman Blanca Rubio and Senator Susan Rubio. We'll be right back.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposures, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive, with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers, and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner. If you're suffering from a work-related injury, Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now, 855-4-RGW-LAW, 855-4-RGW-LAW, or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, giving you a new perspective to enrich your life. Now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Yes, it's Alan Gervie. I'm here with Troy Slayton, and we are talking to the first sisters to serve in the California legislature, Assemblywoman Blanca Rubio and Senator Susan Rubio. And I really appreciate all the work you've done with education and with domestic violence, some really wonderful areas that need reform and need assistance. But I gotta ask you, as an attorney who's represented injured workers for over 25 years, and a lot of them are from your constituencies, why the heck do you not focus on some of the inequities that exist in our system. We have had such a problem since Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor. They brought these things called the medical provider networks, which are controlled by insurance companies and employers, and utilization review and independent medical review. All of it denies all of the treatment. I just got 30 independent medical reviews, and every one of them denied the treatment to these injured workers. These are your constituents who are not getting treatment to go back to work. You've talked about how you were given the opportunities and you've taken it and run with it to get to where you are, and people can't get back to work because they can't get treatment. What are you guys doing in this area?
So this is Assemblymember Blanca Rubio. I sit on a committee called JLAC, which is the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. It's both the Assembly and the Senate. And I recently, just to your point, I was in human resources way before I was a teacher. So I dealt with workers' compensation and, you know, all of that kind of injured worker scenario. And a couple months ago, I asked for an audit for the qualified medical examiner pool for the workers' compensation system. As you know, and I'm sure a lot of people that have been involved with the workers' compensation system, you know that it's a big monster. And so for me, I've tackled one thing at a time, because trying to do everything, and I'll be really, really honest with you, part of the disappointments of being in the legislature has been the bureaucracy. And we all know it's bureaucracy. Like, that's never been any secret. But the amount of bureaucracy that I've seen kind of prevents us from taking a magic wand, if you will,
right,
to say, okay, workers' compensation system, it's got to be fixed. And so for me, I have to take it one piece at a time, because I know that if I go after kind of the whole system, for example, it's not even going to move out of the original committee. The bill's not.
And I understand that, and I think that's an intelligent way to look at it. There are a lot of your colleagues like Eloise Reyes and Connie Leyva who have looked at individual issues, especially this treatment issue. How do we get that to the legislature? Because I know Eloise and Connie have done a great job. You have friends there. How do they look at it? We don't have Jerry Brown in there anymore, and I think Gavin Newsom probably is more open to looking at people who are really suffering. What is the next step?
Well, for me, like I said, my step was to audit that particular issue, and the audit found that, yes, in fact, there wasn't enough qualified medical examiners, that they were being biased, et cetera, et cetera. And we can send you a copy of the audit report for that particular section. But the challenge, again, I'm being really, really honest with you. If I go in there and say, hey, workers' compensation system, this is how it's going to work, the legislature, in my opinion, because of term limits, afforded the building to run the legislation, as opposed to the assembly members or the senators. A few years back, if you were elected to the assembly, you were only able to spend 6 years in the assembly. And the way I described it is the first 2 years, you were trying to figure out where the bathroom was. The second 2 years, you were actually, like, you figured out the system and you were doing some good legislation. And then the last 2 years, now you're worried about what your next step is going to be. For those that wanted to go back into, you know, continue their political career, they were running for something else. And for those that didn't necessarily have another political position in mind, it was like, what am I going to do next, right? Trying to get a job or trying to move on. And to me, that did a disservice to the amount of power that the actual legislator has, because if you only got really 2 years of a good legislator, there was no institutional memory anymore. Now, since we have the 12-year system, now we're giving the opportunity to actually tackle, like I shared with you earlier, one item this year, and then the next year, let's tackle something else. The following year, let's tackle something else, because now we do have the institutional memory within the legislature to say, hey, we tried this 2 years ago and you told us, because there's always an excuse as to why not do it, right? When we go through our bill process, the department that's going to be affected always weighs in on, no, this is not so.
All right. Well,
and if you're,
on a limited time span, you kind of take their word for it. Well, for us, I don't take their word for it anymore.
Okay, well, we have a limited time span, unfortunately, but I want to see the audit. I'll follow up with you on that. I want to thank Blanca Rubio and Susan Rubio. What a pleasure to talk to both of
Certainly
you today.
A pleasure. Even though they didn't endorse me, they sound like amazing, amazing women.
Good luck. Are you there?
This show was furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.